This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. On this week's hour-long Compass special, we join the hundreds of scientists, farmers, tribal elders, students, and environmental activists who came to Port Townsend from around the world recently for the Global Earth Repair Conference. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
Elizabeth Hoffman, I live off Dyes Inlet in Bremerton, Washington.
Joanna Compe, Connecticut River Valley, Northampton, Massachusetts.
Wow.
Jerome Ossetowski from Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture in Colorado.
I'm Kelly Clark from Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
Kurt Clevenson from Costa Rica.
Alan Booker from Huntsville, Alabama.
Dan Halsey from Minnesota.
Jenny Pell from Maui, formerly Port Townsend.
They came to Port Townsend from around the state, around the country, and around the world. Indigenous grandmothers and scientists, permaculturists and farmers, activists and students, all looking to learn or share the skills and the wisdom they could bring home with them to carry out the vitally important work of mending the broken ecosystems that have catapulted the planet into its sixth great extinction event. Alan Watson Featherstone came from Scotland to talk about his lifelong effort to reestablish his homeland's forests. John D. Liu came from China to talk about international ecosystem restoration camps. Mike Meese came from Montana to talk about the Buffalo Field Campaign. Precious Fury came from Zimbabwe to talk about Regeneration International's restoration efforts in Africa. Dr. Thomas Garreau came to talk about saving the world's dying coral reefs and reversing global warming. And dozens of other experts came to make more than 150 presentations on subjects ranging from biochar to the role of fungi in earth repair to tribal stewardship to soil science. There were guided field trips to local restoration efforts, including the Elwha River, to view the return of the wild river following the removal of two dams 7 years ago, and to Tarbu Creek to view the wetland and forest restoration projects being conducted there by the Northwest Watershed Institute. But the one thing all of the more than 600 attendees who came to the Global Earth Repair Conference at Fort Worden came for was the kind of exchange of ideas they hope will cross-fertilize the global campaign to reverse ecological collapse that is being carried out everywhere at the grassroots level, often without government help. Compass producers were at the three-day conference with our microphones, so this week, and then again for the show originating on May 27th, we will bring you a pastiche of what we heard and what we learned. You may hear references to the GERC, which of course is the somewhat affectionate acronym for the Global Earth Repair Conference.
We're going to ask Agnes if, Auntie Agnes, if she would say the opening prayer for us, and if you could all please stand.
Oh, Great Spirit, look down upon us today. We are here for a common cause. We are here because we know where we are. We know who we are, and we are very proud, only because that you have rested your hand on our foreheads. You have given us the life that we have. Dear Lord, bless each one of these children, each one of them.
Kupshit Pucha Wayikmanahi
to go into English. This is my youngest son. His name is Chowawatiek. My mother gave him the name of the chief of the village of the last deed held along the Snake River. Both of our families, my mother's family and my father's, were from the lower Snake River. And we're here on behalf of the cries we hear from Mother Earth and from also our relatives that are in the ocean. You know, when the good Lord created this land, he created it for you and I's good. And all we had to do was to be respectful and to take care of it. And we have not been doing that lately, not for the last 75 years. And now we're beginning to see the price that everyone's going to pay, not just you and I, but those that are occupants of our sea, our rivers, that fly, even the forces, the elements. We're here to remind you that even though you may not hear distinct language from the earth, she does speak.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jeremy Sullivan. I'm chairman of the Port Gamble Tlalim Tribe. And I really warms my heart to see you all here today. And I wish my only regret today is I didn't bring my son with me to show him how important it is to value earth, to value the water, to value the cedar, to value the Clumichin. Clumichin is an orca whale, and we're fighting, we're doing everything we can to save her, bringing back the salmon, bringing back the habitat. We're losing more habitat faster than we're gaining habitat, and that's really scary, and we need to turn that around. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here when I say things like that, but I think that would be the only thing that I wish I would have brought my son. Not to mention, he's a really good singer for our songs, our Tlalim songs. And I really appreciate the richness of our culture that is coming back. And in our culture, we have a relationship with nature. It's not just that we value the cedar, it's our relationship with the cedar. And our relationship with the salmon. Salmon is our way of life. It's how we sustained ourselves for many centuries. So it's valuing those things and bringing it back to our children and having them understand that these things will bring us into the future. A lot of people are looking to indigenous people now, looking to indigenous ways to make sure that what was there before is gonna be there in the future. Seven generations out, we are the seven generations. So we need to make sure we value what is going to happen for the next seven generations. And I think that we are doing a really good job right now. We have a long way to go. We did a lot of damage for a lot of those generations, and we need to understand that we can bring it back. The cycle can go back. We can have clean water. We can have clean seas. We can have a clean ocean if we do the right thing. So I raise my hand out of respect for each and every one of you today. Thank you for being here. And now I'm going to turn it over to Kurt Grinnell.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Kurt Grinnell. I'm a councilman from the Jamestown Tlalim Tribe. I'm here on behalf of Ron Allen. Wasn't able to make it today, but he sends his greetings and good tidings. And Jeremy here really said it. We're all here together in peace and really looking out for our next seven generations and how we're going to get there. And we have a lot of good spirit here today. I can just feel it. I know some of you folks here, and it's really good to see you today. So I'm going to hand it over here to my daughter Lonnie, and we're going to sing a couple of songs.
Hoo-ya-ho, hoo-ya-ho. Hoo-ya-ho, hoo-ya-ho, hoo-way! Hoo-ya-ho! Hoo-ya-ho, 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 hoo-way!
this river has been most of your career, in a way.
Yeah, I actually worked in the park, National Park Service, on trail crew and on fire crew for 2 years while I was in college. And I hiked to the headwaters of the Elwar, within a mile of the headwaters. I actually took the regular trail. There's a side trail to the headwaters. But anyway, I walked up the Elwar and out the North Fork of the Quinault. And I just thought what a beautiful river it was, except it didn't have any salmon. They're just gorgeous in the park.
Have you been up there again recently?
No, I haven't.
But you have seen fish come back to the river now.
Oh, yeah, we've seen lots of fish. It gets better every year. We had like 7,100 Chinook come back this year. The largest, we had seen since the state rearing channel opened, the largest return we'd seen was only about 4,200.
The other place I'm expecting will have changed is I'm going down to Mount St. Helens.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, that might be a little
I was there in 93 because I wanted to see the natural process of recovery, because all the work that I've been doing in Scotland is based on mimicking nature, how nature does things. So it's a great example of that. So I'm expecting to see big changes in the 26 years since I was last there.
Were there any big takeaways you took from St. Helens, or observations when you saw it right after the...
Well, it was just that because there's a self-sustaining natural ecosystem around it, that things were recovering of their own accord. There was no need to plant trees. Mm-hmm. The seeds were coming in, and there was a lot of herbaceous plants growing on the ash, and I watched chipmunks running around, their cheeks bulging, sort of seed dispersal agents at work.
Awesome. So I was listening to a podcast recently about recovery after wildfire, and I was so surprised. It's hard to really believe it. It was a fire ecologist who's in the interview, and he was saying that it's actually not a function of how far seeds have to travel in to the fire to recolonize. They always will, because creatures will bring them. And that we don't need to do any restoration after fires. And it was just like, are you sure? Really? Could it be better if we did some restoration? But that's what he was saying anyway.
Well, I think, it's obviously been the case. There's been fires on the planet for hundreds of millions of years. And ecosystems recovered after them.
They didn't need human intervention. Climate change. Perhaps they can't, old forest species can't get established.
Yeah. Well, I think the difference now is, and certainly in Scotland, where virtually all the forest is gone, there's no seed source. And
totally.
That's why we have to plant trees, because regeneration would occur, but it might take 100 years for the seeds to find those places and get started. And we see, in close proximity to existing native forest remnants, you get regeneration as soon as browsing pressure is removed. But once you get away more than 200 or 300 yards, very little seed fall there. And with no predators and still lots of big herbivores, the sparse regeneration just doesn't have a chance. So that's why we have to intervene to tip the balance.
How have the herbivores maintained themselves on brush?
Well, they've compensated for the loss of their forest habitat by reducing in size. So what you call elk here, we call red deer.
Oh my gosh.
Really? It's the same species, Cervus elaphus. And in Britain, the red deer are about 2/3 of the size that they are in continental Europe. And probably even a bit smaller than they are here in North America.
Island ecology.
And that's because they've got a much impoverished diet, and they're exposed to the elements because they don't have shelter anymore. They make do on heather and lichens and things. Plus they get supplementary feed from landowners in the winter. Because landowners want more deer, because they make money out of trophy hunting of them. So they've been feeding the deer in winter to increase the population, and of course that's just devastating for regeneration.
So what I do is I bought solar panels. I made the initial investment with investment funds, but though that is a type of investment that pays you back with incentives and savings. And so every month I track how much I'm saving on my electric bill, which I will be saving forever. It's like $30 or something. So that stays in that pool, right? And so I can use that pool as it accumulates to make another abundance of investment, like to buy a heat pump for my rental.
Hi, are you familiar with the idea of carbon tithing?
No.
This is an idea that occurred to the Port Townsend Friends meeting, the Quakers here, back in 2016 when we were having a kind of plenary session talking about our social concerns for the year, and everybody was freaked out about climate disruption. And we were bemoaning the fact that there was no carbon tax in the offing, when one of us said, you know, we're Quakers and we're kind of known for like doing things on our own, and there's no point in waiting for the government to like do something about this, because they're just not going to. So if we think that there should be a carbon tax, that means that we should pay something for our carbon use. So every time we fill our tank with gasoline, we should pay maybe a tithe, which is 10%. We also liked the word tithe because it's paying what you owe to the sacred. And
to the sacred.
To the sacred, yes. I mean, like, it's a sacred duty, in a way, to pay your tithe. And we felt that every person needs to somehow take responsibility for their own part in climate crisis. So we Quakers moved slowly, and we talked about it, and there were a lot of people who brought up objections, like, you know, well, I'm too poor, I have trouble like paying my rent, and so how can I afford to like pay another 10%? I'm taxed enough. But we realized that the answer to that is yes, fine, okay. So maybe you can't pay the money, but you can still tithe in the form of action.
Okay.
You could plant trees.
Right.
You could go out and do a work party to like restore a wetland, or you could
tithe in the form of action.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So,
money or action.
Right, money or action.
But where would you tithe the money to?
We started our own fund at the meeting. We just said, well, we're a nonprofit, and so we can just have people like write a check to the meeting. And so this actually is the first expenditure. We sponsored the GERC for $1,000.
My name is Carolina Putnam.
And I see that you're a presenter here at the Global Earth Repair Conference. Mm-hmm. What are you presenting on?
I'm presenting on cross-cultural pollination.
And what is that exactly?
Well, I've been living in Peru for 7 years with an indigenous family, and I want to share about how we can integrate and work with other communities in a way that's respectful and based on reciprocity, rather than making our own ideas fit into another space. But how can we come from a place of listening and really create a cross-cultural collaboration?
What kind of work have you been collaborating on?
We are building an ecological sanctuary in Peru. The indigenous elders are not allowed to go to Machu Picchu or any other sacred sites to do their ceremonies or to wear their traditional gear, their traditional clothes in public spaces. And so we are creating an ecological sanctuary where those traditions can be carried forward. And part of the talk that I'll be sharing is, so our indigenous elders really want to share with people how to feed the earth spiritually around the world. And then what I see that's coming from the West is how we can actually return to feeding the earth physically. So this is the exchange that we create there. I'm sharing ecological roadmaps and permaculture there within the indigenous community, how we can start to meet in a middle path rather than recreating the systems that we know don't work in the Western world, because a lot of those communities are progressing forward with this ideal to meet the modern world, and we're backtracking and asking indigenous elders for support. So how do we meet in the middle and share wisdoms and share the gems of wisdom from both cultures?
So could you tell me your name, please?
Michael Pilarski, also known as Skeeter.
And you are actually the organizer of this whole affair here. What is your greatest hope for the lasting effect of this conference?
Well, I would hope that this will help stimulate that grassroots global earth repair movement that we need, which is all performed locally, decentralized, locally controlled, dreamed up by the local people, but that it just is in so many parts of the globe that it becomes a global movement of local people taking action in their own areas. You could say that this is already happening, and we're supplying them with information and inspiration through all of the videos and all the talks and things that we're having here and are capturing and putting up on the web, so that we have a body of knowledge that will serve the greater movement.
My name's John D. Liu.
And you have been why don't you tell me what your career has been in?
Well, I went overseas when I was 26 as a journalist, and I helped to open the CBS News Bureau at the time of normalization of relations with the United States and China. So that was, I first went to China in 1979.
And you've been doing a lot of work around regeneration. What do you think is the most urgent action we need to take right now?
Okay, well, first I'll just finish the other part and still try to be concise. I covered the news for 15 years for international television networks, and then the World Bank asked me to film a baseline study for the Lus Plateau Watershed Rehabilitation Project. This is the birthplace of the Chinese civilization in the upper and middle reaches of the Yellow River. And when I did this, I was able to begin to compare the importance of ecology to the geopolitical events that I had been covering in the news, and I just determined that the ecology was more important. So that led me to the last 25 years, I've been an ecological researcher with a number of fellowships in different institutions around the world. So that's how I got to this point. What is the most important thing that we need to do? We need to understand that the Earth is a living organism, and that the systems that created and constantly filter and continuously renew the atmosphere, the hydrological cycle, the soil fertility, and the biodiversity are understandable, and they are dynamic, so that they're now at the time that we call the Anthropocene. We are a force which is causing them to be altered massively. Basically, the landscapes now reflect our consciousness. And we have been acting from self-interest or greed and from ignorance. And we know very well that we're destroying the ecological systems. What we don't know yet is what will happen if we act from consciousness and generosity. And I think that's where we need to do right now.
You were talking earlier about these camps that you've been involved with, and could you describe that project to me?
Yeah, the ecosystem restoration camps. The idea is that actually, physically, what we need to do. So we need to do some things psychologically and philosophically in order to get to the point where we want to act as a species on a planetary scale. But when we get to that point, what we need to do is infiltrate and retain all available moisture wherever it comes down. And we need to build up fertile soils, living soils, and we need to propagate and plant out mainly indigenous and endemic plants and allow for a succession so that eventually you don't have a domesticated landscape, but you have a successional evolutionary outcome, a climax equilibrium. So ecosystem restoration camps are basically the lowest cost, most effective way to make that happen, to engage everyone in this activity. This needs to be the intention of human civilization. It has to replace the concept that the purpose of life is to go shopping with the purpose of life is to ensure life continues for future generations.
If you're using sugar or molasses like the EM1 users do, you are going to be favoring acidic bacteria and fungus. And now, naturally, you go into the fungus, look at the soil food web over there. Doug fir is going to have a pretty acidic soil. Mushrooms secrete a lot of acids to chelate ions out of the minerals. And so naturally, fungus are going to be creating an acidic soil. But what was the innovation from the Jadam organization, or, you know, the idea they stole and repackaged, however the history gets written, is that if you use a simple starch source, such as a boiled potato or oats, you will end up, instead of having something like EM1, a lactic acid dominant, you know, thing that is at a pH of 3.5 and shelf stable for possibly years, you make a very quick brewing non-aerated compost tea. So in the Genome system, I really like this because we'll go around and go into a healthy, undisturbed ecosystem and get some leaf litter. So it's just under the actual, like still, like, visible leaves and get down to that black, loamy soil. And so, you know, again, it's like 50,000 species of microbes in one teaspoon of soil is the common thing passed around. And because in a healthy ecosystem, 40% of the photosynthesis is getting sent down to the roots to tailor its microbial connection to the soil food web. So seasonally, from the same tree, you would get different microbes if you went to that same maple tree every time, because the root exudates are tailoring the microbes they need at that time.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to an hour-long Compass special on the Global Earth Repair Conference that recently took place at the Fort Worden Lifelong Learning Center, bringing together ecosystem regeneration practitioners from around the world. All right, so first, why don't you start by telling me your name?
Oh, so I'm Tom Goro. I'm the president of the Global Coral Reef Alliance, and I work in basically an ecosystem restoration in the ocean and on the land as well.
So I saw that you had a talk that I was unable to attend. You've had several talks. Yeah. But, you know, like the one that I was thinking of was specifically restoring the coral reefs, which is a subject that really interests me because, to me, I mean, having swam over dead reefs in Hawaii and been just deeply saddened, I've thought that it was hopeless. So there is hope for the coral reefs.
Well, I mean, there's yes and no. The thing is that we've invented a method that we've been using for 30 to 40 years all around the world that greatly increases the settlement, the growth, the survival, and the resistance to severe environmental stress, including high temperatures and pollution, for corals and all marine organisms. We're stimulating their growth, they're growing faster, they're healthier, and therefore they're surviving conditions that would otherwise kill them. So we're able to keep whole reefs alive with our method, but we have to give them a trickle charge of a very low trickle charge of direct current, which stimulates their metabolism. It's very low, you can't even feel it, but it makes everything grow faster. They're attracted to the electrical field, they settle more, they grow faster, they survive conditions that would kill them. And not just corals, oysters, seagrass, salt marsh, all marine ecosystems, oysters, fisheries habitat, everything. So it's a remarkable method. We're doing it on a very small pilot scale because we work with no money and people don't believe what we do is possible until they see it themselves. So, and
where are you doing this work?
Well, we have done about 500 bio-rock reefs around the world. About 400 of them are in Indonesia. We've lost count, but we've done these projects in about 40 countries in all kinds of marine habitats, and they seem to work in every one. We were able to restore fisheries habitat. We attract huge numbers of baby fish. We create the habitat and the food for them at the same time. And our reefs also do something else reefs do besides maintaining fisheries and biodiversity and tourism attractions. They also protect the coastline from erosion. So we grow reefs in front of severely eroded beaches, and the beaches grow back in months. I mean, it's just staggering. Severely eroded beaches, and that's, you know, a few months later, there's a whole new beach here.
Simply by doing electrical current?
Yes. Well, we build, the thing what people don't understand is they're building seawalls and breakwaters, and those concentrate the force of the waves, increase erosion. They cause everything in front of the wall to be washed away, the sand, then it washes away the sand underneath, and then the wall falls down. That's inevitably going to happen sooner or later because of the physics of the situation. What a coral reef does is very different. It does not reflect waves and concentrate the power. None of that effect. The waves pass through the reef because of lots of holes and crevices and cavities, and so the energy is dissipated passing through all those complicated channels without being reflected. So there's no erosion. The result of that is that behind them, the beaches grow because the wave energy is dissipated offshore, and we're creating a whole ecosystem that's, you know, that no concrete wall will do. So, you know, and it costs, you know, something 10 times less than the concrete wall as well. So the costs are vastly lower, the benefits are vastly higher. But basically, we very few people doing it. And meanwhile, almost every beach in the world is washing away due to global sea level rise and increasing storm strength driven by global warming.
I'm Heather McRae-Wolf.
I know, Heather, that you are an educator and that you have spent quite a bit of time thinking about a subject that I've heard come up several times today, which is, how do we educate our children around climate disruption?
I think the whole question of where the Earth is now calls on us to think differently about how we're raising children and educating children in general. It's not just a question of how do we tell them about climate change, although that's an important question, but it's how do we raise them so that they can be in love with nature and feel their own integral connection to a part of nature. And one of the things that we are going to be offering this summer is a camp called Trees and You. So I am offering a camp in partnership with the Port Townsend Friends Meeting and with some guest teachers. And one of the reasons that we're offering this is to give an opportunity for young people to come together and really take some moments in communion, really, with nature and with the trees. And so to have some moments of sacred connection and play and joy and interaction. And in that process, I imagine there will be some moments of grieving as well, or some moments of sorrow, of noticing the clear cuts that have happened, of noticing trees that die, of noticing that cycle of life and the environmental tragedy that is happening around us. And that may come up in the process of our conversation and our interaction, but I think the most important thing is to find that really deep rooted connection, so to speak, with nature itself.
What is your name?
Charles Eisenstein.
And how do you describe your vocation?
I'm a writer and a speaker.
Okay, and on what subjects?
The overarching theme is the change in the stories and even the myths that define who we are as a society and that underlie the world that we create and that we live in and that we are creating. Yeah.
Okay, I have to admit that I had never heard of you until this conference came along, and then everybody was very excited that Charles Eisenstein was coming in. So I read a little bit, and one of the ideas that I really immediately sort of recognized on a heart level was that nostalgia, I guess, for the image that we all like grew up with of a safe, secure society where if you followed certain steps, you could have certain results, and we were all like, you know, these autonomous individuals and so on, and then countered with a vision in which we feel ourselves to be what we are, which is a part of everything, and how we need to transform our culture to that worldview. Yep. I'm sure you've given a lot of thought to how that might happen.
Yeah, we had a story that told us how to do life and what the world was and where it was going. You would get good grades, go to a good school, get professional training, family, career, investments, retirement, you know, the whole shebang. Here's how to do it. You get sick, you go to the doctor, and it works. And that's been falling apart in every single one of those domains. You know, the marriage is the family in a box model, that's not working. The go to college and you'll get a good job, that's not working. You end up with debt instead. You get sick and the doctor will fix you, that's not working with the rising tide of autoimmune diseases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then on a collective level, that technology and science are going to make a perfect world for us and life is going to get better and better. That doesn't seem to be working either, right? The ecological basis of it all is crumbling. So people are in a state of bewilderment where they're either grasping for an old story that's falling apart and trying to hold on to it even more tightly and make America great again, or they're just in a state between stories and opening maybe to a different story of who we are, why we're here, how to do life. And so like you asked about how does this process happen? It's like an initiation where who you had been isn't working anymore. And you don't know who you are. So there's a breakdown that creates the conditions for something new to come.
Well, maybe a personal story would help. Your story implies an awakening. You know, a point where you said, oh, maybe this whole like individuality thing that I've grown up with, this way of seeing myself, sort of turned itself on its head. And you started to perceive yourself as being a part of a greater whole, as it were.
I mean, this knowledge lives in everybody, and it is suppressed in various ways as we are acculturated to become separate, rugged individuals, self-reliant and independent and financially independent, and we don't need anybody. But the knowledge that the knowledge of our interbeing, our interconnection, our interdependency is, that's primal. So I can't say that there was like one event that reawakened it in me. Maybe it was less effectively suppressed from the outset. I mean, I've certainly had, you know, revelatory experiences and awakenings and things, but I don't see myself as exceptional in that way. It's more like I'm being carried by a rising general tide of consciousness that's changing. I mean, this is happening to everybody. I'm just good at giving words to it, but I'm not like some, you know, especially enlightened person.
Oh, how disappointing. I'm going to end the conversation right here. All right, so here's the question that I'm going around and asking everyone. What do you feel is the most urgent and attainable change that we need to be making right now? Oh.
I guess it depends what you mean by attainable. Something extraordinary has to happen, because in our current political culture, even the tiniest positive change seems unattainable. But with that disclaimer, I would say that it has to be radical demilitarization, for one thing, because the $700 billion military budget just of this country, not to mention the global one, is an embodiment of our collective will and creativity and values and beliefs. And as long as that remains the biggest single expression of our collective will, then the huge changes that are necessary to heal this earth are not going to happen. Our intentions and beliefs and creative energies are powerful. So that would be one thing. And then just even more mundanely is to change agricultural policy away from subsidizing industrial agriculture and toward regenerative practices, which not only heal land and water and soil and community, but also are even more productive when they're done well than chemical intensive industrial practices. So this would require a shift in agricultural subsidies. Wouldn't even be that hard. You know, there are charitable foundations and organizations that are already doing this work against the tide of agricultural policy and subsidies. So it's really, really doable. The way we're doing it now isn't working anyway, you know. Ask the farmers in the Midwest. I mean, they're barely hanging on and in desperate situations. So, you know, I think the other priority is conservation and restoration of damaged ecosystems beyond the agricultural.
How about the cultural shift that needs to take place in order for these changes to come about?
The cultural shift goes all the way down to the base level of who we think we are, what is a self, why am I here? One of the primary expressions of that, though, would be a shift from separation of humans and nature to participation, to understand that the earth itself is alive and intelligent and conscious, that it's a being, a sacred being, and that it's not, our ecological crisis will not be solved by being a little bit more clever in how we dispose of the resources and how we operate a machine. It requires a shift of consciousness into a relationship with a living being that we hold sacred. Once we do that, everything will change. But if we don't do that, then even if we switch to carbon neutral fuel sources, the degradation of life will continue. Reducing the problem to a matter of greenhouse gases and carbon is really a band-aid that ignores the the fact that this planet has a physiology, and that if we continue to degrade the organs, like the soil, the forests, and so on, even if we cut emissions to zero overnight, the planet still dies of organ failure.
Do you perceive that cultural shift is being underway?
Absolutely. I mean, this conference is testament to that. Yeah, I mean, people are really falling in love with the Earth. 100 years ago, the conquest of nature was a good thing. People believed in it. They resonated with that, yes. And now, the healing of nature is much more appealing to most young people.
My name's Mike Meese, and I'm the co-founder and campaign coordinator of the Montana-based Buffalo Field Campaign.
So tell me a little bit about the campaign.
Well, first off, let's clarify. There's 600,000 bison in the United States right now. But of those, less than 10,000 are genetically pure and not what we call beefalo. The rest are all mixed with the cattle bovine gene, but physically looking at them, you cannot tell a difference. And of these less than 10,000 that are genetically pure, the only ones that aren't basically landlocked in places, fenced and fed hay and essentially domesticated are the Yellowstone herd, which are the last descendants of the 30 to 60 million that used to roam continent North America. And so the Montana livestock has really put a lot of pressure to have zero tolerance for these animals to migrate into their states. And of course, that's where all the low elevation habitat is for year-round, you know, security for these animals. And so for the last 22 years, we've stood on the front lines, documented anything that happens to these bison when they come out, of course, done acts of nonviolent civil disobedience as individuals, and went for an endangered species listing for them in November of 2014, and kind of fight on all fronts to just get these sacred animals the right to be what they are. Regenerators of our earth, taking care of it, and come outside of this square box known as the Yellowstone Bison Reservation and allow them to give that gift back to the earth. And so I think that's why they invited me here, because everyone is understanding that it's going to take more than just us humans to clean up this mess, but a lot of these animals naturally do what we're talking about doing here.
If you're using sugar or molasses like the EM1 users do, you are going to be favoring acidic bacteria and fungus. And now, naturally, you go into the fungus, look at the soil food web over there, Doug Fir is going to have a pretty acidic soil. Mushrooms secrete a lot of acids to chelate ions out of the minerals, and so naturally, fungus are going to be creating an acidic soil. But what was the innovation from the JADOM organization, or the idea they stole and repackaged, however the history gets written, is that if you use a simple starch source, such as a boiled potato or oats, you will end up, instead of having something like EM1, a lactic acid dominant, thing that is at a pH of 3.5 and shelf stable for possibly years, you make a very quick brewing, non-aerated compost tea. So in the JADOM system, I really like this because we'll go around and go into a healthy, undisturbed ecosystem and get some leaf litter. So it's just under the actual visible leaves, and get down to that black, loamy soil. And so, again, it's 50,000 species of microbes in one teaspoon of soil is the common thing passed around. And because in a healthy ecosystem, 40% of the photosynthesis is getting sent down to the roots to tailor its microbial connection to the soil food web. So seasonally, from the same tree, you would get different microbes if you went to that same maple tree every time, because the root exudates are tailoring the microbes they need at that time.
What I really want to spend my time focusing on is how simple things really are when we start to work on the right things. I'm really, really concerned that the mainstream environmental movement is really hitching our cart to the wrong horse. We're always talking about CO2 and greenhouse gases, and the reality is we're focusing on something that's invisible and that our actions cannot see immediate results. And so if we create carbon sucking machines, we won't even know for a couple of years if that's even starting to make any impact, and the people that really will feel that impact will be people decades from now, not the people today. And when you start to look at water and you start to really work with the watershed, you start to revive the health of soils, you start to infiltrate water into the landscape, you get something that's very actionable. The rise in temperature is not going to kill people. It's the watershed death spiral that is killing people right now. And that's something that's really important. You have to see these places where people used to have water year-round, but because they cleared the forest, their springs are dry. And so now these people don't have water to drink. They're drinking out of mud holes. They're bringing it in from kilometers away in deep borehole wells, just making it all worse and worse and worse. Now, when you start to work with the water, when you start to respect and have reverence for water and life, everything magical just starts to happen. People see the results of their actions the first rainy season. After the first monsoon, they can see that their actions delivered water for the dry season. They can see that their actions created more vegetation. It's not for logic that we're focusing on greenhouse gases. It's for convenience. It's very inconvenient to have to look at our land use practices and think, what is the impact in these areas? It's much more convenient to just push it to something external, invisible, that's one factor. And so we're simplifying the complexity of nature down to something that doesn't actually hold up in reality. But when humans start to work with water, you have to see these landscapes where I've been places where you're driving through a barren man-made desert, places that burn, places that don't receive precipitation that they used to because humans have changed the vegetative cover. Now, when humans really start working with the water, they really start infiltrating that into the soil, they start building the life of the soil, the diversity of the above-ground vegetation, you're driving through those deserts, and then you reach oases. You reach communities that are water self-sufficient in the most extreme landscapes you can imagine. And so when we start to reframe the narrative and really look at water as life, it's 70% of all life is water. And if we start to change our work, moving that into the 95% of the global heat dynamics versus focusing on the 4%, not only will it balance out all of these climate extremes, the different issues that we're having, but it actually enhances the quality of human life.
I mean, I think a good model is there's a movement called the Movement for National Regeneration of Mexico, Morena. And they had an idea to let's take over the government, you know, and let's seize control of the federal budget and let's cut all the corruption out and let's redistribute the money to the people, including like massive reforestation projects, help for small farmers, help for young people to go to get educated and so on. So last July 1st, they won the presidency with 53% of the vote. They took over both houses of their government. And then in December 1st, they actually took power. And since they've been in power, they did things like shut down all the corrupt government bureaucracy around the country, sold off the presidential airplane, raised taxes on the rich. And there's like a $1.3 billion reforestation program going on in Chiapas this year. That's just for this year. And it's going to be, you know, not your normal sort of corporate industrial forestry program, the real deal. They're paying, it's like we're getting 6 new staff people for our organic farm and our organic grocery store, because the government will now pay young people directly, they put it on your credit card, $100 a week to intern and be an apprentice. And you know, we're gonna pay more than that, but $100 a week in Mexico for a young unemployed person is a lot of money. Wow. So I'm just raising this point that I don't think we have time to finance the regeneration revolution at the pace that we're doing it. It's not that our intentions aren't good, and it's not that we don't have great creative ideas, but we got to take power in this country, and we got to do it quickly, you know, and we got to take that $1 trillion, for example, that we spend on war every year, and military stuff, and we got to restore things before we're all, you know, perish. And then if you look closely, like after the Green New Deal was put out, some economists like Ellen Brown from the Public Banking Institute came out and wrote articles, how could we finance a multi-trillion-dollar Green New Deal? And she said, well, have you ever paid attention to this new school of economics called modern monetary theory? You know, I mean, one of the advisors for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is she's a professor at some Northeastern university. They're basically saying, look, what is money? Money's an IOU, right? Well, why do we give an unelected Federal Reserve system of creepy bankers the power? Because all they do is they call up the printing press that prints the money, and they say, turn it on. Yeah. Okay? That's what money is. It's an agreement that somewhere down the line, this IOU, someone's going to pay it. But it's just like, we got plenty of money right now to finance saving the earth.
So, Dar, as a climate reporter, you've witnessed so much destruction firsthand. You've said that humans are in a hospice situation with the planet, with the industrial culture certainly is inarguably in hospice. And the future, you've said, is guaranteed to be pretty catastrophic, but that we can do the right thing anyway, even if we don't expect that to change the planetary crisis. So I'm curious, what does do the right thing anyway mean?
Last June, I met a Cherokee elder named Stan Rushworth who reminded me of the distinction between, in Western colonial settler mentality, we have rights. What are my rights? Versus indigenous wisdom, which teaches us we're born onto this planet with obligations to serve the planet and future generations. And so if I get up today mostly concerned about what my rights are versus getting up and asking, okay, whatever I pray to, the great mystery, how can I best serve you today? And what actions can I take to best serve future generations? So regardless of however bad the outlook is, and it is bad, I have no shortage of things to do. So, you know, you look at the kids, the climate strikes, the walking out of school, how am I serving them? Am I doing enough? What else can I do? There's, you know, it's limitless, it's bottomless. And I'm actually extremely excited and interested, while simultaneously, I cry every day reading what each report is, because I know exactly what it means. You know, the most recent devastating study that comes out, you know, like most recently, the permafrost is basically melting away before our eyes to the point where scientific instruments measuring it can't even stay on top of it that fast. Yet, how am I going to comport myself during this time, and what are my obligations? And so I have found a deep and abiding motivation now and a fierceness to serve.
As one way of assuring that there is lasting value from the tremendous fount of information about the techniques and practices of regeneration that was the GERC, most if not all of the presentations from the conference were videotaped and are available on the Global Earth Repair YouTube channel or on social media at hashtag Global Earth Repair Conference. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website. where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.